here we are. Last week we started in on this session, which is actually our final session in this series we've been doing on space and time and knowledge. And at the end of this six-week session, we will be halfway through the program. So anticipating just a little bit, I can congratulate you on being almost halfway finished with the program. I met a few days ago with a couple of people in the program who were also attending a retreat at Ratna Ling, that was not a TSK retreat, and we talked a little about how the program is going. They gave me some interesting feedback that I've been thinking about, and I may make a few changes, but I'm not going to do it this week. No. The only change that I will definitely do starting this week is really commit to having us do a practice just for a little while and a little longer than we've usually been doing it each week. So that's my commitment. Okay. Let's get started. And actually, what I want to say is related to that conversation with Eliana and Philip. So the first thing I want to say about knowledge, you know, we've been working with space and we've been working with time, and now we're working with knowledge. And there is a sense in which you could say that when it comes to knowledge, it's a little more abstract than space and time, because we have a sense of space and time, you know, being immersed in space and time along with everything else in our world. And so in that sense, it's a little bit, you could say it's concrete. Whereas knowledge is a little abstract, you know, you can't point towards it in quite the same way. People say just the opposite, actually. And I think that's probably a little more accurate, which is that when we're dealing with knowledge, we're dealing with what's the most immediate thing. Because the way we know is what determines the world that we inhabit and the experience that we have. What we know, our way of knowing is fundamental to our possibilities. And so in that sense, when we're starting to deal with knowledge, we're dealing with something that is really primary. It's the way we engage the world. And so what that means is that, you know, there's always this tendency in TSK, the kind of critique that people make is they say, well, it's too intellectual, it's too abstract, something like that. And it's not. and it's my job and your job in terms of investigating the vision and also in terms of teacher training, it's our job to really understand why it doesn't make sense to say that TSK is abstract. And I think now that we're focusing on knowledge, we have a really good way of thinking about that and understanding it. Because the world that we know is exactly the world that is problematic in so many ways, the world in which we feel frustrated and unfulfilled or incomplete, the world in which we're confused and uncertain, in which we feel pressure and anxiety all the time. And they really have to do with space and time and knowledge, and you know, that's fundamental to the whole project of activating the TSK vision, is to recognize that as we do that, it's as though we're moving to another world, you know. So I'm saying that the kind of knowledge that we use is really what determines our world. And so this notion that, you know, you might say TSK is abstract, is exactly wrong, because what we're talking about is everything in our world, everything that we experience. And of course, we have this tendency to think of world in a kind of an objective sense, you know, what we see through our senses. But I'm talking much more broadly. I'm talking about the world as including all of our inner environment, you know, our emotions, our feelings, our thoughts, our memories, our moods, and all of that. That is what we want to, that is what TSK is all about. It really is about transforming our ordinary way of living. And so, as I said, it's kind of up to all of us to find a way to make the vision into something that's not abstract, but that is really engaging every part of our life. And the walkabout that we did for last week was a kind of a start on that. And we'll do a practice in a few minutes that is basically the same thing. It's central now to what we're doing. You know, every moment in our lives is shaped by a limited vision. And the possibilities in every moment in our lives are determined by that vision. We're trying to activate a new vision. So every time we have a problem, every time we have a negative emotion, every time we feel confused, every time we feel bored, that's the world we live in, and that's what the TSK vision that we're aiming to activate would transform. Klaus says, yeah, TSK is abstract in the same way that water is abstract for a fish, and that's a nice way to say it. You know, we often say, oh, you know, fish don't know anything about water. So if you talk to them about water, they say, well, that's a very abstract concept. So yes, Klaus, I think that's a nice way to say it. That's good. So we're looking at time and space and knowledge. And here, especially with knowledge, because in the sense that I was saying before, it's really fundamental to the whole picture. Now, the way that gets set up in the reading, in light of what I've just been talking about, the point that's made at the very beginning of the reading is that the self is always taking up positions. And that view, that approach, I should say, is exactly at the core of our ordinary vision of reality. It's the self's vision of reality, if you want to say it that way. So there's this fundamental conflict between the self's wish to take a position and love of knowledge. And that, I want to take a few minutes to really lay out that distinction because it's so fundamental here. When you take a position, you know, that has to do with space and time, but the actual taking of the position is a knowledge act, right? And the moment that you say, now I have a position, then you've turned that act of knowing, which is what takes the position, into part of the possession of the self, the position that the self has. So there is a quote that was quoted in the reading in When It Rains for these 2 weeks that has a passage that I really love in Love of Knowledge. It's from earlier in the book that says, in one unified motion or action, the self takes a position, posits a situation, and imposes meaning. One of the reasons I love that sentence, I probably have talked about it before, is the playful way in which it uses the words position and posit and impose. They all have the same root of pose or put. The word literally means put. The position is, you know, the act of knowing, you could say, is taking the position, although you could talk about that differently. The positing of the situation, that is setting up the whole space that you inhabit, and the imposing of meaning, that's the temporal order in which things make sense. So those three things come together every time we take a position. So that's what the self does. Now, if you look at the bottom of page 313, it offers the alternative that the TSK vision really is about. It says, if we accept the possibility, this is the second paragraph, if we accept the possibility that positioning can be an expression of knowingness, in other words, it's not that the self takes a position, but that there's this ongoing activity in which the self positions itself. So you could say, okay, the self does take a position, but that's not where we identify. We're aware of the ongoing act of positioning. So if we accept the possibility that positioning can be an expression of knowingness, without turning that acceptance into a position, okay, the bystander's concern for maintaining positions drops away. So that's the particular way of looking at the self as the bystander. Carolyn has a question, which I'll get to in just a moment. I want to lay this out first. Okay, so the bystander's concern for maintaining its positions drops away. Our intention is left open and free, all-allowing and all-encompassing. We're not limited by the position that the self imposes or takes or posits. Right? And then it goes on to say, this openness, this not being bound by the position, this is the true love of knowledge, a love that turns from the concerns of the self, allowing knowledge to know without limitation. So in terms of the level of knowledge that we're looking at now, this is the fundamental point. I gather there's still some problems with hearing me. Let me know if it's gotten bad, and I will do the alternative, but that would take a couple of minutes. Okay. So so back to this point. We're talking about something really fundamental. It's too bad that there's a little interference here, but that's how it goes. The love of knowledge is exactly the opposite of the concerns of the self. So, you know, on the one side, you have the self and its concerns and its worries and its fear and its anxiety and its confusion and its boredom. This is a little list we could memorize and recite to ourselves, but it should be a list that also refers to our experience, right? It should be very familiar to us. That's what we have on the one side. And on the other side, we have the love of knowledge. So you could literally say that the love of knowledge is a selfless love, right? It's when we give up the positions of the self. And I really want to suggest that you know, it's important to take that seriously. There's a place, I'm on the phone. Does that sound okay?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. Boy, I don't know whether to try to go back over some of that. I was really saying that the fundamental issue or the dichotomy here is central. But if we take seriously what he's saying here about the love of knowledge, right? A love, as he says, that turns from the concerns of the self, that is great love. That is what he's talking about. And to help make that point, I want to just read the very end of Love of Knowledge. If you have the book there, you can take a look. It's the last few lines on page 410. I'll skip a little in this last paragraph. The turn away from knowledge, has brought us to our present situation. Now it offers the opportunity for an unparalleled adventure. Alive to the luminous potential of knowledge, we can question ourselves as actors in the dynamic flow of history. We can resolve to free ourselves of the limits that narrow our vision and undermine our well-being, like a lover absorbed in the beauty of the beloved, we can give ourselves to knowledge. The depth of our love will disclose the range of our vision. So it's a very beautiful passage. And, you know, he's not just joking here, you know, or he's not just using a metaphor. And I think it goes back to this question of why people think that TSK is abstract. You could say it has to do with, you know, when you say to people the love of knowledge, people say don't really take that seriously for the most part. In the same way that you'd say, you know, the love of your husband or wife or boyfriend or girlfriend, or the love of your children, or the love of your pets, whatever it is, you know, the love of nature, love of knowledge doesn't sound anything like that, but it is. That's what Rinpoche is pointing to. If we can engage the love of knowledge in that way, then this is something fundamentally different. Let me go back now to a couple of questions that have been posed. So Caroline asks, is this what is meant by the reference to knowledge not being a function of experience? Yes, I think it is. We talked about this a little last week, that the word experience is way too closely tied to a self that is having the experience. I think we dealt with that in a more sophisticated way, you could say, last week, but this is the way that, you know, just pops into my mind that I think is fine for our purposes. The self has experiences. So when we talk about experience, you know, we think we're going very deep. We think we're talking about the immediacy of experience as opposed to the conceptualization of our ordinary way of thinking. We get rid of all that. We go to experience, and there is something valuable in that, of course. But it stays committed to the self that's having the experience. Knowledge, you know, love of knowledge goes deeper than that. I think I won't, if you want to discuss that or ask more about it, feel free, but that's all I'm going to say about it right now. And then Ron asks, do you think the positioning of the self is what creates what we consider the unconscious? Yeah, that's an interesting question because I think it's very the term unconscious or then subconscious, but especially unconscious is it's not very clear. I think in our culture, actually, we don't have a very clear sense of what we mean. I mean, people tend to mean very different things. That's my sense of it. And there is sometimes a sense, anyway, that you know, there's a deeper knowledge accessible within the unconscious, and I think the way you've put it here, Ron, is more accurate than that. The self positions itself, and by doing that, it creates a realm that's accessible to to consciousness, and then it also creates an unconscious realm to which it normally doesn't have access, but let's imagine maybe sometimes it does have access. So you could say that the whole dividing of experience, I think it's okay to use that word here, the whole dividing of experience into the conscious and the unconscious realms, or maybe the conscious, the subconscious, and the unconscious in some systems, that's just an expression of the logos that the self, that sets up a self, right? Or the readout, that's the word that's used in this chapter, which is, you know, the readout of the logos, really. The readout, which gives us a self that has a certain amount of conscious experience, also gives us a self that has a very limited amount of access to the unconscious. So yeah, I think the positioning of the self it encompasses that. I think that's a good way to think about it. It's one model. So Caroline continues, how can knowledge be known if not through experience? It seems there's a difference between knowingness and experience, the former not being governed by the senses, but the latter being dependent on them. Well, I'm not sure about that. I mean, I think the connection to the senses is important when we're trying to understand what we mean by experience. Because usually when people talk about going to direct experience and dropping the commitment to concepts and going to direct experience, they are thinking of sense experience. Just let the tree be a tree, as one philosopher wrote, you know, or just let your relationship to the flower that you're looking at be immediately available at direct experience. So there is a connection to the senses. And when we talk about knowing this, which is more, you know, which was what was referenced in at the beginning of this chapter, it does go, maybe I'll say it goes deeper, but I'll try to explain in a moment what I mean. So you say, Caroline, there's a difference between knowingness and experience. The former is not governed by the senses. The latter depends on them. So, right, what does it mean to say that knowingness is not governed by the senses? Well, what it suggests, I think, is that there's always an active positioning going on. And so the self in that act of positioning, the self gets established as the one that's doing the positioning. And so if the self is having direct experience of a flower, let's say, then that whole complex, you know, that is a position that relies on direct experience, but the whole complex in which there's a self that's directly experiencing the flower, that's what's available to a knowledge that we access when we're open to experience, when we're open to what appears in the love of knowledge. So, as he says at the bottom of 313, to go back to that, a love that turns from the concerns of the self, allowing knowledge to know without limitation. So you could say that direct experience is a modality that's available to the self. And when we tune into it, we open up the range of possibilities for the self. But the deeper knowing, the love of knowledge, is the openness to the whole. It's always, you know, I suppose the theme that we've been exploring and that I've kind of been exploring for myself for some time now, with regard to this level anyway, of the TSK vision, is that we're always looking for the whole, you know, the feel of the field and the embodiment of the lived story. And I've been trying to find exactly the right language, maybe the life of the logos. We're always engaging the whole, whereas the self is always carving out and trying to own some particular part of the whole. So love of knowledge has to do with openness. And as it says again in this passage, this paragraph on 313, the true love of knowledge is leaving our intention open and free, all allowing, all encompassing. So that's another way of talking about the whole, and actually seeing that passage helps give me confidence that you know, focusing on the whole is a good way to do it. Okay, so that's a kind of statement, you could say, of what the what love of knowledge and it is, why it's important, and in what sense it's not abstract. So the question is, why do we treat it as abstract? Or why do we think that it's somehow, you know, when Rinpoche says love of knowledge, he doesn't really mean love, you know, he means, I don't know, we admire knowledge or we respect knowledge. No, he's talking about love of knowledge. So why don't we, you know, why can't we really engage that or I'm going to say grok it for those of you who know that term. Well, you know, we talked last week I just noticed there were a whole bunch more questions, so I got distracted. We talked last week about all this. I don't remember exactly where I was going. So let's go back. Let's see what else people have been saying here. And we're at a point where we can then do practice. I just promised at the beginning of this conversation that we would always do practice, so we're going to do it. But let's take a look at what people say. So Ron says, I don't think knowingness excludes the senses. I've already addressed that, I think. And Ken says, what if knowingness and experience are given together? I think you'd have to maybe work a little bit, but I think, you know, what we talked about before is also about that. Experience is an aspect of the whole. There is a self that experiences. There is a world that's experienced. And that is the positioning. That's the readout that we get in every moment. But if we go to the whole, if we go to the all-encompassing and all-allowing nature of knowledge, then we're there. You know? So experience is given as part of knowingness. And Philip says, perhaps relaxing the positioning allows us to stop labeling certain experiences we all have outside conventional knowledge as coincidences. That's a good example. You know, it's a little bit related to the question that point Ron made or wondered about whether the positioning of the self or the way that the self takes up positions leaves an unknown realm of the unconscious. And it seemed to me that was right. And I think you could say the same thing. You know, what's a coincidence or what's a miracle? You know, it's something that doesn't make sense. This is not a very good way of saying it, but it's something that doesn't fit within the logos. It doesn't cooperate with the kind of sense making that we're doing. If we're ready for a more all allowing, all encompassing way of engaging what appears, then those kinds of things might show up. Caroline thinks that she likes what Philip said. And Ken says, such a paradox, focusing on the whole. Where does the one focusing stand? Well, that's very interesting. So there's two things to say about that. One is, when I started to read your comment, Ken, I thought, well, okay, there's a paradox in the sense of focusing on the whole, because focusing always means narrowing in, right? Taking a particular point and making that your focus. So how can you focus on the whole? So that's the first thing you're saying. And then the second thing is the question, where does the one focusing stand? And I think that that's the answer to, or that's kind of a comment to the paradox that you mentioned. It's not really focusing on the whole. I mean, that you're right. It's not a good image for that reason, because the whole point here, what's central, is that everything that shows up, including the self and its experience and its capacity to experience and what gets experienced and the activity of experiencing and the claims of the self to own the experience, all of it is a part of that whole, or is, you know, not a separable part, but it's involved in the whole.
Openings to the whole.
What did you say? Openings?
Openings to the whole.
I'm,
to focus on the whole, it opens to the whole.
It opens to the whole, right. Yeah, I think that's fine. And Philip agrees here. He says, simply as part of the whole, that's where the self disappears, fortunately. Right. So it's not exactly that the self disappears. Maybe it does. I mean, there may be experiences in which it does. But, it might be there, you know, as a part of the whole or within the whole. There's this self that's experiencing and wondering about experience and analyzing experience. Let me just go to that. On that point, let's just take a look at the first paragraph under the heading on 314. And the heading is important. It talks about knowledge within the logos. So a logos, an order, is set up, and within that we can find knowledge. And the self may be within that too. Just quickly, and then I want to look at the I want to make sure to cover all the comments, but then I need to, we need to do some practice. In this first paragraph, it says, when knowledge is available directly in this way, and I'll skip the rest of the sentence, there's no need to abandon the style of thinking, the forms of knowledge, and the methods of observation that constitute our working system of cognition. We can know knowing in knowing. If the logos itself is an aspect of knowing, then in penetrating and embracing its nature, what else is left to know? So it doesn't say it exactly in this paragraph, but the self is a part of that. You know, the self that uses language, that has thoughts, that is committed to certain methods of observation, it's all there in the whole. So, you know, if you, it's good to think this through, because if you just say, oh, let's, you know, embrace the whole, that may not matter too much. I mean, it doesn't give you enough guidance, I think. Ron makes a point about a sutta by the Buddha, Bahia, that where people say, oh, sense experience, the Buddha's saying sense experience is what counts. And Ron says, no, it's really pointing a little beyond that to the self taking a position. I think that's right, but I'm not going to spend any more time on that one. Let's take a look now, or let's practice just for a few minutes, but a little longer than we usually do, 3 or 4 minutes. The practice is basically the practice that that we were doing before, or doing as the walkabout. So we're talking about staying within conventional knowledge. That was the paragraph I just read. So whatever arises, however you think, however language labels things, however you go about observing, or I think it's fair to say experiencing, let those be positionings within the whole. You just stay within what appears, but you don't make it into a position. You don't define what's happening. You don't say, this is what I'm doing. There's just a kind of an arising, just a kind of steady state arising of each moment. Maybe we've said enough. Maybe we've said enough to make it confusing. I hope not. Maybe we've said enough to suggest how we could go in this direction. So let's practice for 3 or 4 minutes, and then we'll allow just a few minutes for comments, and that'll be it. So I hope the practice is clear. It's very much like the walkabout, or maybe just is the walkabout practice. Just let experience, you could say, but not only experience, arise without taking a position. Okay. Let's take a few minutes to exchange some thoughts or reactions. As we're waiting, I'm just waiting for people to make comments. I'm going to take a look at something Ken said. If the self must show up as and only as a sort of deadening of knowing, we are really downers. Alternatives? I think that what we've said really points toward the possibility of an alternative. The self is not so much the deadener. It's not the one that deadens. It's the taking the position and then insisting on that as our property. It's claiming ownership on behalf of the self. There's a characteristic move that the self makes. That's the downer. You know, that's the dimmer on the light. Everything gets kind of dark and gloomy once we do that.
It's the solidity of the position that makes it so dense.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's the solidity. It's the claim to be real. Okay. So I'm still in the... We're in the transition phase here of inviting a few comments on that practice. Now, maybe we had just gotten so caught up because there was a lot of comment. Maybe we're too verbal to kind of reach out. I'm not sure. Ken has another. Okay. Ken has a comment, I think, on the practice, or through the practice, or from the practice. Radiant openness before positioning, after positioning, and as positioning. Did that ever arise? So I gather that what you're saying, Ken, is arising, and this is a point we haven't really discussed, but arising goes along with taking a position and positing a situation and imposing meaning. We're talking about a level where there is radiance, and we will be working later with some exercises related to light. And actually, the dynamic exercises for this week begin to discuss light. That goes more toward the whole. That undermines the commitment of the self to its own positions. And remember that this chapter has what I think is actually a useful title. It's called Commitment Without Commitment. So we're not committed to what we commit to. We're not committed to what the self commits to. But we also don't turn away from it. Okay, I'm seeing that nobody else is commenting, so we're definitely at the end of our time. So we'll just leave it there. I'm sorry for all the difficulties. Until I can get my computer fixed, I'm going to assume that plus Mercury retrograde maybe was the source of this difficulty. So until I can get my computer fixed, I'll just go ahead and call in by phone instead, because that seems to work just fine. I do see fine. Okay, I'll give Philip the final word because he did make a comment. In the practice, I felt something like a significant relaxation between the cells of my body, and later a reaching out of the senses to embrace much more, and finally an explosion of contact to memory. So relaxation is good. The self is tense. And it's really interesting that you connected to the cells of your body and to your senses and then memories. So the whole range, again, we're talking about the whole. Nothing is going to be left out. Okay, I guess I gave myself the final word. I tend to do that. Okay, let's stop there for today.